Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
My guest today is Clement Knox, who has written Strange Antics, A History of Seduction, which I'm holding up right here, which is an excellent book that's, as it says, study the history of seduction. And seduction has always been around, but we talked a little bit about this before the recording. So it's quite an intriguing and fascinating subject. So how did you come about writing a book on this topic?
Hi, yeah, good to be here. I came to this basically through reading. I was reading very widely in my 20s when I was kind of thinking and started thinking about this subject. And one of the things I noticed was that there are all these seduction narratives in our culture, which have been around since the 18th century, which were there in the very first novels, Samuel Richardson, Jane Austen, Charlotte de Clos, who wrote Dangerous Liaisons. And these stories have been told and retold for the last 300 years. You know, in around the time I was thinking this novel, one of the best-selling novels in the world was 50 Shades of Grey. And 50 Shades of Grey is a direct retelling of Samuel Richardson's Pamela. I don't know if the author knew that or not, but the tropes were there. And there is this deep fascination with this subject in our society. And like with so many things, once you get really interested in something, the first thing you think is someone must have written a book about this. And I was looking around and I found that basically no one had. And so I thought I would give it a go.
We don't start with, you mentioned the introduction in literature narratives. So let's begin with some examples from literature and how that inspired the seduction narrative and how that drove on in the seduction world.
Sure. And before I answer the question, it's important to remember that obviously like literature has a kind of fictional component where people are just telling stories, and there's lots of reasons why you might do that. But there's always a social component in that they're responding to real things happening around them. And so the first great seduction narrative in a novel was Samuel Richardson's Pamela in 1741 or so. Widely considered the first novel in English, although that's a very controversial subject, but it's often cited as one of the first three or so. And that is the story of a young lady who goes to work in the mansion of a kind of dissolute aristocrat. And she is pursued in a way which is, to our eyes, extremely non-consensual. And she goes through all these kind of tragic events being pursued by this man. And eventually her virtue wins out and she can convert him to the ways of, straight living, and they get married. And this was the kind of first ever seduction narrative in novel form. And it was a massive bestseller. It was hugely influential in English society. It was translated into several foreign languages as well, and was one of the great bestsellers of the 18th century. And that kind of began at the very birth of the novel, this fascination with seduction.
And obviously there are so many more examples to go to, but let's begin with one of the most famous seducers in the world, and use this term that, oh, he's a real Casanova, ain't he? So that kind of thing. So let's begin to talk with one of the most famous seducers, arguably, I think. And sure, as we mentioned, Casanova.
Exactly. And Casanova was living around the same time as Pamela was written, and he was from Venice, and he was this kind of traveling con man slash musician slash kind of courtier, and the reason his life is such an interesting sort of story is in part because he wrote sort of 8 volumes of biography, which are one of the most fascinating insights into the 18th century that survives. So I recommend everyone reading that because they are just hilarious and fascinating and kind of unparalleled as a resource. But also, as you mentioned, he's kind of really survived in the popular imagination as a kind of archetype. And one of the reasons I wanted to talk about him was because he represented a very different strain in this history of seduction, whereas Pamela was a kind of a strain of concern and worry and maybe even moral panic. Casanova represented another strain, which was of kind of excitement and joy and sensuousness. And I would suggest that that is a kind of dichotomy which has survived today, where some people are kind of embrace sexual freedom and other people are very concerned about the consequences of sexual freedom.
And let's talk about the life of Casanova, because his life is as well quite interesting. But so like you said, his life is quite interesting in itself, and you spend a good deal talking about him in a book.
Yeah, I mean, like I say, because he wrote so much about his life, it's very hard to synthesize and summarize his existence, because he was constantly moving around Europe. He was constantly getting into these kind of adventures and scrapes. And although he was born in relatively humble circumstances, the son of an actress in Venice, and actors and actresses back then were the kind of very bottom of society, even though they had quite an interesting place in it. He just kind of through sheer force of personality became this kind of wandering public figure who turns up everywhere in the 18th century. It's amazing the number of people who meet Casanova and discuss him in their memoirs. The kind of great memoirist Boswell, James Boswell, encountered him in a sort of German hotel once and recorded it in his diaries. And he had no idea who he was, but he recorded his name, and centuries later, you know, people were like, oh yeah, that was Casanova he met. So he also met Voltaire and was at the court of Louis the 16th, lived in London for a period of time, lived all over the place. I discuss his famous incident in Venice where he got arrested basically for public immorality and ended up escaping from the Ducal Palace from the prison cells in the very top, which I happened to visit during the course of researching the book. So he's just a fascinating figure. The reason he's such a good person to discuss though is because he provides an insight into the whole spectrum of European society in the 18th century, which was an extremely, sexually liberated place, and was very interested in the subjects of sexual freedom and sexual constraint. So he's just a great way into that world.
Let's talk about because arguably what he's most known for is seduction. So let's talk about some of the women he seduced and how. What made him such a good seducer? Was it like you said, he grew up among actresses and he wasn't from the very high society? Did he learn through kind of acting in a way? Or how did he become such a famous seducer? And so let's talk about some of the seductions that he did.
Right. I mean, it's obviously fairly hard to know what the kind of exact truth of the matter is. I mean, he was living in an age where prostitution was very widespread and also quite loosely defined. There were a lot of blurred lines. And there was also a huge amount of what we would consider rape, especially of servants and people in kind of dependent positions. So from the 21st century perspective, he is quite a tricky character. And anyone who reads his memoirs, reads it closely, some of the things that he's describing in these kind of liberated terms to us would just be, you know, you would be in jail for doing that. So I'm very kind of conscious of that. At the same time, Casanova talks a lot about kind of the foundations of what he's doing and the logic behind what he's doing. And a lot of it is based on these Enlightenment ideas of reason and rationality. And he truly believed that people were sort of individual free agents with the gift of reason and that sexual pleasure was something people wanted and people sort of could enjoy together without the kind of constraints of society and morality and everything else. So in that sense, his vision was very similar to the vision of the sexual revolution of the 1960s and 70s of the 20th century. That having been said, in terms of why was he a great seducer, that is a bit of a mystery. I think he actually wasn't a very good looking person. He made quite a bad impression on lots of people who met him. So there's definitely still a kernel of mystery there, which we can't really penetrate from a 300 years distance.
So did he have certain methods that he used to seduction? And as we talked about, there was a lot of persecution around. So, and he said it wasn't very good looking. He said most of the seduction had been prostitutes. Do we know if most of his seductions were from, you know, prostitutes, or did he, you know, do we know any methods that he used for his seduction?
I'm trying to think now. I mean, I say that some of the most famous accounts in the book involve a young lady. I think he knew her father, who was staying in a Venetian convent, which was basically a boarding school where kind of well-born women were kept before they were married. And there's a very long sequence in the memoirs describing his kind of courtship and seduction of her, which involves sneaking into this convent on several occasions in the middle of the night. I think a big part of his method was pretty much that he was extremely garrulous and sort of large living character. He would gamble a lot, go out all hours of the night. I think he was just great fun to be around, and obviously in the end quite a shameless figure as well. I don't know if we can accurately tell from a distance what his methods were and the extent to which they were kind of unique or particularly special. Mm-hmm. And yes, it does also blur into this other problem of was some of this just exploitation that he was dressing up as seduction?
So what did it, that's something else in Italy that was arguably most, you know, that I didn't know about until you wrote the book and I found quite fascinating, is that, you know, concubinage has been around since perhaps the dawn of time. And, you know, mostly it's the male who has a concubine or two, but in Italy, and I believe this was mostly Venice, but, you know, there was females. I don't remember what they're called. They had a very specific name. I can find it up, but look it up. But there were females who had male concubines in Italy. And that's something I found really fascinating.
Yeah, that's a lot of reviewers picked up on that. And the word is cicisbe, which is C-I-C-I-S-B-A-B-E-O. So it's kind of a hard word to say. And I think it's from Venetian dialect. So yeah, it's a strange one. But yes, this was a very, very real, although slightly enigmatic practice, where married women would have basically male admirers who would kind of dote on them. So they would hold the lady's fan or, play the piano for her, or kind of generally keep her entertained whilst her normally much elder husband was doing whatever he was doing. And the sexual component of it is very hotly debated, because some people just think it was basically they were there to keep company. Other people dispute that. This is all happening in the context of Italian society, where often older men, you know, their wives would die or whatever, and they would remarry very young women. And it was understood that there was no love involved. These were kind of social matches. And so normally once the wife bore one child, they were widely considered to be sort of freed from their other obligations. There was a famous pope in the 18th century who was Italian, like they all were, who once made a joke to a bunch of unmarried young women that if they didn't get married, they would never enjoy the pleasures of widowhood, meaning that they should get married in the understanding it was just a transaction. And then once their much elder husband died, they could live freely. But under this kind of female male concubinage in Venice especially, you didn't have to wait until your husband died. You could basically do it as long as it was discreet and out of the way. And Byron, the English poet, he actually wound up in exactly this relationship with Teresa Guiccioli, where she was married to a much older woman, a man, and she took him as a lover, and he was reduced to being basically her kind of footman. And he wrote some extremely upset letters back to England, deploring this custom whilst he was living in the house of her husband in Ravenna and would be forced to engage in this rather, to his eyes, peculiar relationship. One of the reasons he didn't like it was because it gave women quite a lot of power, whereas he was used to these a lot more imbalanced relationships where, you know, this kind of rakish Englishman could get someone pregnant and run away, whereas this kind of system didn't really allow for that.
He found it quite humiliating, didn't he? He didn't like it at all, being, you know, a male concubine.
Yeah, and he said, I would much rather have old-fashioned adultery than this new practice, which I find very humiliating.
Do we know if, you know, like you said, it wasn't about love, but just sexual pleasure, but do we know if the male concubine ever did fall in love with a woman, or do we know if, did that ever happen, or did they understand that this is just a fling, so to speak?
I think I'm sure that did happen. Like I say, it's quite a enigmatic institution because it didn't last for very long. It's probably sort of less than a century, and a lot of the accounts of it come from the outside by basically tourists visiting Italy, seeing this practice and being horrified. I'm sure there was almost certainly cases where these were basically real love affairs, which were being kind of dressed up as this kind of very formal and acceptable social arrangement. But the truth is, we don't know much about it from reliable sources on the inside. And like I say, Byron is one of the few English accounts we have, someone who actually experienced it. And he was obviously very prejudiced and exceptional in lots of different ways. So yeah, it's something we'll never know exactly what the dynamics of it were.
What kinds of men were these concubines? Was it lower class of society, or was it the middle, or was it the higher class that were now to become these male concubines?
It's the social equals of the women involved, because these were very stratified societies. And I suppose, as you can readily imagine, if you were kind of a young man in Venice and all of the women were being married off to these very old men, it would be very natural for people of the same age to be socializing with each other and wanting to spend time with each other. And I'm sure this was just a way of kind of facilitating that in a respectable, socially tolerated way.
If a male concubine eventually got married with someone else, would it still break the bond, or could it be, was it allowed to, you know, continue having his, but then would be a mistress at the time, or was it like over? If it ever happens.
I mean, I think basically everyone was given quite a lot of leeway as to what they did, as long as there was a certain amount of discretion. This is something Casanova talks about a lot, you know, having to constantly be booking rooms and hotels and apartments for assignations, which was basically, all of this was tolerated, and a certain amount of sexual freedom, especially for the upper classes, was celebrated so long as you didn't step over the boundaries. And so there was always a game between sexual freedom and kind of recognizing the formal rules of society.
I mean, this sounds kind of like this could be a great fictional novel to me. Like, you have this male concubine who can fall in love, you know, with this woman he is sexually, and not exploiting, that's the wrong word, but, you know, this would sound like an exciting novel that should be written, you know. It does kind of sound that way.
Yeah, we'll have to find someone with the talents of a novelist.
But another thing that happened in this era, the late 18th century, is, of course, the Women's March on Versailles. So let's talk a little bit about the Women's March.
Right. So, Casanova lived long enough just to see the early years of the French Revolution. And the French Revolution, what you're referring to is this famous incident in October of 1793, where the sort of women of Paris, the kind of women who worked in the markets and the laundries, kind of the working class women, marched on the Palace of Versailles and made the king come back to Paris. And it was he was essentially kidnapped by the revolution and brought back to Paris, where he could be more easily monitored and controlled. And it was a big turning point in the French Revolution. One of the reasons I bring it up in the book is because it gave rise to Burke's famous Reflections on the Revolution in France. It was a direct response to this event. And in relation to it, he says, chivalry is dead, that famous line. And one of the reasons he says that is because he had been working inside this 18th century conception of sensibility and women being these meek sort of creatures controlled by their passions and kind of inferior to men. And the French Revolution, amongst many other things in this period, showed women in a very different light, as kind of dynamic political agents involved in the affairs of what was once considered the domain of men. And it was a real shock. And it shows that the cult of sensibility was in some ways a very conservative institution designed to kind of keep the place of men and women separate and defined. And events like the French Revolution really helped shatter that and created, in part, the modern conservative movement.
Mm. And we don't jump a little bit in time right now, and I apologize for that, but something in the late 19th century is one of the most arguably famous, and I'm fairly sure everyone knows this event of the Jack the Ripper. And how does that fit in the seductive narrative with Jack the Ripper, as you write a little bit about him as well?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, that section of the book about sort of late Victorian London is really an attempt to talk about how the kind of developments in science and social thinking in the late 19th century influenced how sexual behavior and sexual deviancy was understood. So a couple of different things happen. You have the birth of biology, the birth of racial science and racism, and the kind of triumph of Darwinian thinking. And all of those kind of combined to provide these new and quite terrifying ways of understanding sexual pathologies. And Jack the Ripper those murders happen at the kind of the height of the Victorian era. And they happened in Whitechapel, this slum neighborhood of London, which was kind of the seen as the shame of the nation, because it was all this squalor and poverty and prostitution concentrated in one area. And the Jack the Ripper murders were an occasion for people to look into that neighborhood and see this dark reflection of Victorian Britain. And the reason I talked about it in a book about seduction is that a lot of people hypothesize all these various explanations for what was going on. And they suggested that maybe these women were being seduced and then later murdered, something which has been picked up on many films about this era. If you see the Johnny Depp film From Hell, that's kind of implied in that there's a kind of seduction element, and then it turns into these horrific murders. Another interesting point of reference is that Whitechapel was populated by a large number of Eastern European Jews who had migrated to London. And Judaism and seduction were kind of very much linked in the late 19th century, because Jews were outsiders, and so they were feared on that basis alone. But also, Jews were held to have these magical powers.
That is hilarious. That is... So funny now that, you know, they believed that the Jews were, you know, these seducers who had this magic powers to lure a woman. And you do show some art in the book as well. Of, you know, that is also from the Nazi, which Germany, which we are going to talk about in a second as well. But, you know, it's funny how they, and absurd in a way as well, how they thought that these Jews had this power to seduce this woman.
Right, but and you know what's so interesting about this era is obviously Freud is just around the corner, and Freud is going to provide explanations for this on the kind of the subconscious. But so much of what's the discourse, as you mentioned, is so weird and so ludicrous that is almost kind of foreshadowing these kind of psychological explanations and Freudianism. But it was taken pretty seriously. Another book I discuss in that chapter is Trilby, and Trilby is by Du Maurier, and Trilby was a massive bestseller in this period. It's just huge. It's hard to overstate how influential it was. The Trilby hat, which is still a term used today, is derived from that novel. That was kind of one of the things that survived from the Trilby mania, the late 19th century. And that entire book is based around this figure of a Jewish composer and impresario who sexually and psychologically dominates a kind of Irish soprano. And so I show some of the images in that book, from that book in my book. And it's horrific in its kind of crude anti-Semitism. Mm. But it shows that these were ideas abroad at that time. And when you try and understand it, we have to start thinking quite deeply about what was going on. And one of the things I would say is going on is people are trying to reconcile observable human behavior. You know, the fact that men and women interact, they mingle, they court, they fall in love, all the rest of it, with certain ideological preconceptions about racial purity and national health and the kind of monolithic Victorian ideal. And when those two, when the reality and the kind of fiction come into conflict, you end up with these very strange ideas which are represented in the culture.
Mm. And another novel that you speak about, and I think the thing about this until I read your book, is that Dr. Jekyll and Dr. Hyde, they do fit somewhat in the seductive narrative, and you explain it quite well how they fit in.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Jekyll and Hyde is not a book about seduction, although it has been interpreted as a book about homosexuality. Mm. So there is a kind of psychosexual interpretation of it. But it's interesting because it is about these kind of strange biological, racial understandings of human behavior. Because Jekyll is this kind of Anglo-Saxon ideal, upstanding, intelligent, Victorian Superman. And Hyde is this simian, malevolent, atavistic creature and they inhabit the same home, and they inhabit the same person. And so again, if you want to work the conscience versus the subconscious, that's a very powerful image of that. I discussed it in the book because it was dramatized at the Lyceum Theatre at the exact same time as the Jack the Ripper murders were happening in Whitechapel. The Lyceum Theatre is on the Strand, so only 2 miles away from Whitechapel, one of the most famous theatres of its day. And many people at the time drew this connection between the Jekyll and Hyde on the stage and the Whitechapel murders happening a few miles away. And they both were kind of episodes in this kind of strange understanding of behavior from a scientific, racist, Darwinian, psychosexual perspective. And it was kind of a very shocking illustration for Victorians of kind of drama and fiction overlapping into reality at the same time.
I remember writing about this up-and-coming actor who really get witch-hunted, if you will, for lack of better words, because they didn't think he was Jack the Ripper, because I wasn't the guy that played Dr. Jekyll and Dr. Hyde at this point, and he was, you know, and again, to draw comparison to today with social media as well, it's easy to, you know, find a victim. There was this documentary, not that this is, it's kind of relatable, but really, you know, about this woman who disappeared in Skid Row, and, you know, they hunted this guy who was at Skid Row a year before, and he became suddenly the victim, and they ruined his life, you know, because they thought he murdered her, which wasn't the case. But, you know, in this case as well, they found one person, and they started to chase him, and everyone suddenly started believing that this man is Jack the Ripper, you know, so... It's easy to ruin someone's life once, you know, you find, and like I said, this is true for today as well. When once you find someone, think someone is guilty, it's easy to get that man's life ruined, as with back in the day of Jack the Ripper.
He was accused in letters to the Times that this actor, who, as you say, was playing both Jekyll and Hyde, that was kind of one of the gimmicks to draw the crowds in. And they had to close the play. They had to end it and give money to charity and do all these things to try and make good. And he ends up being so basically hounded out of London. It was a huge financial disaster. Like you say, moral panic was very real, and obviously in Whitechapel, at least, extremely understandable.
And another novel that you write about is arguably one of the most famous novels in the world, which has been made several films as well, is Frankenstein. So explain how that fit in to the... And again, you did quite well in the book, because Frankenstein as well fit quite well into the seduction narrative.
Yeah. So Frankenstein, obviously written by Mary Shelley, she, as a young woman, had this extraordinary period where she was living and traveling with Lord Byron, and obviously Percy Shelley, and Mary Shelley's half sister, who ended up being sort of seduced and abandoned by Byron. They had a child together, Alba, who was Byron kind of quite cruelly disregarded for many years, and then eventually decided he wanted her to live with him, and forced his ex-lover to surrender the child. The child was brought to Venice and almost straight away died. So very tragic story. Frankenstein famously was written in the Year Without a Summer by Lac Le Mans in Switzerland. And there was this night where the story goes, they were all telling ghost stories. And the ghost story that Mary Shelley told ended up becoming Frankenstein. Frankenstein is interesting because it's often read as a kind of parable about technology, which it obviously was. I mean, she was very well-versed in kind of the science of the day, and it was kind of fashionable to talk about galvanism and that kind of thing. But it was also a book about creation and the perils of reckless creation. And one way of thinking about Dr. Frankenstein is that he is engaged in a reckless procreation. He gives birth to something which he discards. And that is kind of a metaphor, I think, for Byron's kind of very cruel behavior. And there's a moment in Frankenstein where Frankenstein confronts Dr. Frankenstein, and he says to him, "How dare you sport with life?" And I think that is Mary Shelley talking to Byron.
It's talking about something like you said, "How dare you sport with life?" I don't know, throw when I was the sun and you threw me away, something like that, I think.
Exactly. And I think, and Mary Shelley was a very perceptive, intelligent woman who lived very close to Byron, but in a kind of protected position as Percy Shelley's wife. And I think she was definitely very, very impacted by what she saw, especially because her father, Good Godwin, had been a very enthusiastic proponent of sexual freedom, again, like Casanova, along these lines of kind of Enlightenment rationality. And he wrote a very weird book where he talked about how the family was going to become extinct and men and women would raise children together and everyone would meet on terms of perfect, rational sexual parity. And Mary Shelley's life, in part, was a kind of refutation of that idea. And she saw the kind of tragic consequences of what happens when sex meets power. And Byron had a lot more power than her sister.
And something I want to talk about as well, I'll jump a little again, is in the early 20th century America, where segregation was a big part. Back then and all the way up to the late 60s. And one prominent young man who was a boxer of African-American descent, he is the boxer Johnston. And he spent quite a long time, because he was as well a seducer, but what was perhaps so special about him was that he also seduced. And this is quite fascinating, especially if you know a little bit about early 20th century America, it's seduced white women as well. It's not just, I mean, people wouldn't have cared less if it was African American women, but because it would as well seduced white women, this was in that time outrageous.
Yeah, Jack Johnson, one of the most fascinating figures of his day. Like you say, he was a black man born in Texas during Reconstruction, and he became a boxer as a young man and went on to become the first black heavyweight champion of the world, which was a big deal back then because boxing was the most popular sport in the world. I think that's a defensible claim. And all of the boxing champions were white, and they refused to fight black fighters. It was called the color line, and there was lots of pressure within the media and within societies for boxers not to risk losing the heavyweight crown to a black man, because that would be considered like a racial defeat. Mm-hmm. This is, again, the same kind of racial stew of ideas that I was talking about in Victorian England were, as you mentioned, very much current in America and across the world. Johnson, you know, he was an athlete. He was a sportsman. He was a good-looking guy. He had lots of money. He had a fun time. And yeah, women were a big part of his existence. And he didn't respect the color line, as it were, when it came to romance. And so he had white wives and white girlfriends at a time when those kind of liaisons were illegal in large parts of the United States. And frankly, in many places, didn't really have to be illegal because you would get killed. This was the heyday of lynching. There were several incidents he was involved in which could have been turned into lynchings had he not escaped. And in fact, the response to some of his victories were lynchings and race riots all over the United States. So yeah, I think everyone should know about the story of Jack Johnson, both because he was such an amazing character and such an interesting figure, but also because his life really foreshadowed so much of the kind of the civil rights movement and what happened later in the century. Muhammad Ali said that the greatest boxer who ever lived was Jack Johnson. Not because he was more skilled than Ali would never say that, but because of his bravery, because he lived a certain way at a time when it could really get you killed. And he was a huge inspiration for Ali and a huge inspiration for many people in the civil rights era.
And you talked about riots, and even in the African American community, there was riots. If he won one time, and you write about this kid who just was strolling alone, and what's happening? There's a riot going on because I think he won. I don't remember exactly the story, but they had this riot because of his either victory or defeat. I'm not quite sure. Remember the details, but yeah.
The story you're referring to is Louis Armstrong, the famous jazz musician, as a young child was a newspaper boy in New Orleans, and Jack Johnson won a fight, and the white community started, and the black community started celebrating, and in response, the white community started rioting.
Right.
And Louis Armstrong saw another boy running down the street, and he asked him what's going on, and he said, Jack Johnson won the heavyweight title, and now there's a riot, so you better get out of here. And he ran away. And he put that story in his memoirs, 50 years later. These were kind of landmark events. The riots attending Jack Johnson winning the heavyweight championship of the world were the biggest in the United States until the 1968 riots that followed the assassination of Martin Luther King. So that puts in perspective that these were massive events. And the root of it all was his race and the fact that he was well known for having white girlfriends. And this combination of kind of sexuality and sporting prowess just really, really did not fly with white America.
Because it does get banned from the United States at some point as well, doesn't it?
Yeah. So this requires like a bit of explanation, because what happens with Johnson is they can't defeat him in the ring. They try, they send everyone, all the great white hopes, as they were called, and he beats them all. He just can't be beaten. So they go after him using the law. And the law they use is the Mann Act. The Mann Act was originally founded to fight prostitution. It's still actually on the law books today to fight prostitution or what is now people trafficking. But at the time, it was used both to fight people trafficking and also to police sexuality. And the law said if a woman is transported across state lines for immoral purposes, then a federal crime has been committed. The FBI was created, its early years, it was created to enforce the Mann Act. So this was a big deal. And after he retained the heavyweight title for in a huge defense match against one of the most famous boxers of the day, and he knocks him out, they file charges against him on the Mann Act. And rather than, and he's found guilty, as everyone expected he would be. And rather than go to prison, he flees to Canada and then goes to the UK. And he was in London basically during the First World War. He actually was in Russia when the war broke out, and he had to get, he had to flee back to London. And he basically sat out the First World War in London. And then he went to Havana in 1917, and he lost the title there. And after that, he kind of drifts around for a while, and eventually went back to the US and served a period of time in prison.
Doesn't he try to become an agent or something for the US at some point?
Yeah, Johnson's life was really, you couldn't make it up. It was really something. He went to Spain for a period after he lost the title fight, and did try and become a spy. I think he was actually recruited for a period, and then he kind of spent all the money on things he shouldn't have, and they let him go. But yeah, just another episode in a very strange life.
It does continue while in banishment. It does continue his boxing career as well, I think, in London, right?
He tries, but basically the boxing kind of ground to a halt because of the war. A lot of the great boxers are fighting in the trenches. And a lot of the interest in the sport is being sapped away. And also boxing at that time was quite an international sport. Jackson won the heavyweight title for the first time in Australia, to give you some perspective. Like, he was used to traveling around for fights. There was lots of back and forth across the Atlantic.
And again, we have to remember there were commercial fights at this point in time across the Atlantic, especially, or at all, so to speak. So we had to take... It took quite a while to travel these
distances. Yeah, he was taking the liners. But yeah, all of that comes to a halt during the war. He ends up basically just becoming a kind of music hall curiosity in London. Isn't able to train very much. And when he does get back into the ring, it's kind of a very drawn out and quite brutal beating by Jess Willard. Quite a sad end to his career as a boxer. But he remains this kind of icon of both sporting ability and kind of the early civil rights movement.
And wasn't it because, I don't do forgive me if I screw up a little here, but wasn't it because of Johnson that, you know, they tried to do, was that the Mann Act, the failed seduction attempt to put seduction on the court of law, or was that later?
The Mann Act had already been passed by the time to Johnson.
Because I do remember you speaking about, you know, how there was this attempt to put seduction under law as well.
So it was complicated because basically the problem in the UK and in the USA was that most people did not want to have seduction laws on the books criminalizing this behavior. For the very simple reason that at this time, most of the electorate were men, most of the lawyers and judges were men, and they didn't really want to pass a law that was going to exclusively target men and discipline male sexual behavior. So a lot of the campaigners who were pushing this legislation were women. They were proto-feminists, in some cases avowed feminists, and also kind of sympathetic men, often from the temperance movement or the chastity movements, kind of, you know, usually Protestant campaigning evangelicals. And so because there was great resistance to having seduction laws on the books at a federal level, there were lots at a state level. They had to use other ways. And the Mann Act, which, as I said, was designed to police prostitution, was that way of doing it. It was kind of a way round of the kind of opposition to a formal seduction statute, but effectively acted in the same way. In the UK, a very similar thing happened where they were unable to pass seduction laws, although they tried. And so they passed the 1885 Criminal Law Amendment Act, which criminalized lots of things around prostitution. It also famously criminalized homosexuality. Oscar Wilde was punished under that law. And these were kind of routes to trying to discipline male sexual activity through the back door. And there's a strange and persistent relationship between the seduction narrative and prostitution. And it's one of the themes of the book, that there's this constant counterplay between how we think about sex work and how we think about seduction.
And I wanted to bring up another episode, speaking of sex work, just a while, a month or so ago, I don't exactly remember, we spoke about sex and sexuality in the medieval era. And, you know, back then there were actually bishops and, you know, priests that had these constitutions for prostitutes, that they just looked at it as it's another way of life that men need, you know, sex in their life. And they actually may help these prostitutes by either you could become, you know, if you married a prostitute, you get a certain amount of, you know, money. I think I'm not quite sure, you have to listen to the episode because I don't remember exactly how it goes, but you know, they had these institutions back in the Middle Ages for prostitutes. Even the church actually helped with this back then.
Interesting. Yeah, I'll have to listen to that one.
But anyway, something that I think you should write more about as well is the seduction narrative. And again, we did jump a little in time here, so I apologize for that. But the Nazis and the Nazi Germany is as well a big part of the seduction narrative.
Right. And we discussed earlier this kind of very strange complex of ideas around Jewishness and magical powers and sexual exploitation. And that was present in Dracula and in the Jack the Ripper discourse, and was kind of generally accepted across Europe and the United States in the late 19th century that Jews were heavily involved in prostitution, which was seen as this kind of systematic exploitation of white women, and it was called the white slave trade. So, and this was an idea that the Nazis really ran with. If you read Mein Kampf, Hitler talks about the white slave trade directly. He writes these kind of, you know, screes about the kind of Viennese Jews who were like pimps and playboys and exploited white women. This is all in his kind of interpretation, obviously. Then when they're in power, one of the things the Nazis do is to try and stop Jews intermarrying with so-called Aryans. And they do lots of small things and some quite big things to basically try and stop what they viewed as this kind of compulsion on the part of Jews to kind of seduce and hypnotize, and in some cases enslave in sexual bondage non-Jewish women. So it was, and some of these cartoons I show in the book, a reprint in the book, from these sort of anti-Semitic publications that the Nazis bankrolled, really dramatically illustrate this idea that Jews were kind of trying to corrupt the body politic by seducing Aryan women.
I found one here, and if you're watching on YouTube, you might see here's a caricature of Nagy explain about how the Nazis portrayed Jews seducing the women.
Exactly. And it's one of these ideas which, if you see it in isolation, you might just think, oh, this is just another horrific thing the Nazis did, which obviously it was. But what I try and do in the book is situate that within a larger context of the white slave trade as a kind of discourse. This kind of idea of seduction being involved, this kind of scrambling of the rational mind, which kind of overlapped with this sort of ideas of the Jews having magical powers, but also kind of being agents of the subconscious within these kind of placid Western societies. So that there was just a lot going on. And it's no surprise that Hitler picked up on a lot of that, because it wasn't a minor thing. These were subjects that were discussed in the news every day in the late 19th century when he was growing up. And, you know, there were white slave trade conventions in London. There were laws passed nationally and internationally to combat this kind of craze. So these were all big things in the world of the late 19th century. And it's not an accident that it ended up being a feature of kind of Nazi anti-Semitic discourse.
And of course, it's the Nazis took this to a whole other level. But like you explained, Europe in general was really a very anti-Semitic in the early 20th century. It wasn't just Germany and Hitler, like you said. It's most of Western Europe, and I don't know to what extent America was, but they were really anti-Semitic in general back then.
Yeah, and you know, we talked about Jack the Ripper earlier. I mean, a lot of those books about strange things happening in the cities in the late Victorian period, a lot of those are talking about what are they talking about in these communities like Whitechapel, which have been transformed by immigration. And these are basically books which are discussing either implicitly or explicitly the kind of psychosexual fears that demographic sort of change has created. So there's always this kind of relationship between fear of the outsider and a kind of sexual panic over, like, you know, they're going to come for our women. The same thing still happens today. I mean, we all know that is a trope of like right-wing immigration discourse, for instance. So these are expressions.
I mean, see Donald Trump and the way he, you know, treated Mexicans in his political agenda. It's based, you're not the same level, of course, but, you know, it's there are similarities there.
Right, right. Yeah, and the anti-Semitism of the day drew upon like very old anti-Semitic stereotypes, but also quite modern as well. So it's definitely a part of the story I wanted to include, because it's a kind of a tragic footnote to a lot of the themes I discussed in the second half of the book.
And speaking of the second half of the book, something that is main big happening in the 60s is the hippie movement, and as we spoke briefly about earlier, it is the sexual liberation. And something I found fascinating when I was listening to your book and when you spoke about this is that I don't remember who spoke to an ex-hippie, but he said, he asked the hippie, you know, was there sexual liberation? And he says, no, there wasn't.
Yeah, that's from Atomized by Michelle Welbeck, very caustic critic of the sexual revolution, quite prophetic critic as well, because I think in the last 5 years especially, there's been a big revisionism of the 1960s, 1970s sexual revolution. And I think it's gone from being this kind of thing that was either celebrated or kind of gently mocked by kind of the likes of Austin Powers or whatever, to now being...
South Park does a great job of making fun of hippies, yeah. Especially with the episode where Cartman tries to get into the hippie movement and they have a South Park, when they have a hippie Woodstock in South Park.
I'll have to look that up. But yeah, you know, it's definitely, it's transitioned from this kind of quite good-humoured, irreverent treatment of the sexual revolution to a slightly darker interpretation. And I think the 60s and 70s are quite a misunderstood era today. I think we don't really get it right. And I think the sexual revolution is definitely something we are only starting to really understand. But one of the things I would say, I discuss in the book, is that at the time, the arguments they were making in support of sexual liberation were very, very similar to the arguments being made in the Enlightenment. They were basically claims that, you know, human beings are rational, all of these controls on sexuality and behavior are irrational and are kind of hangovers of religion and other superstitious practices. Mm. Basically, if we let everyone do what they want and be free, they'll do what's in their best interests and it'll be work out fine. So it's a very rational economic model of human behavior. And so maybe rather than thinking of it as liberation, you can think of it as liberalization. Mm. Kind of liberalized an economy, we just liberalized the sexual economy.
Mm. Has the hippie movement and the sexual liberation in the hippie movement, has it been oversaturated, do you think?
I think the hippie movement is one of those things that, like, it was over before it began, really. I mean, basically, you had the Summer of Love in 1967, and that's kind of the high point of the hippie movement. And then after that, it becomes like a cliche slash a joke, such that by the 1970s, I'm not sure many people are calling themselves hippies. It's kind of like hipsters today. No one confesses to being a hipster, but obviously other people assign the term. So I think I'm not sure there are many people who by 1972 or so were embracing the hippie term or the word. But again, the 60s and 70s were quite a radical period. And there were literally hundreds of thousands of young Americans who moved, who ran away from home, who moved to communes, who moved to kind of squats or shared housing situations, and did live or try and live in this kind of liberated, non-conventional manner. Mm. All of it was to do with sex. A lot of it was to do with ownership and property and just ways of living. Mm. But sexual liberation was a big part of that. And challenging the kind of monogamous norm was a big part of that. And we're still living kind of downstream of those experiments.
And I know you don't really write anything about this in your book, so sorry if you can't talk much about it, but from the 80s, and I want to talk a little bit about this, when rock bands become a big part of the culture and musical, you know, with Motley Crue and everything, on all these kind of rock bands, and they kind of do fit, I think, in this inductive narrative as well, because you do get this groupies that comes to the band, and you know, you have these rock stars ending up sleeping with a lot of their, you know, fans, and like you said, they're called groupies. And would this be appropriate to talk about a little bit about the rock star, not movement, but you know, how they, I do think they kind of fit a little bit into the movement, into the seductive narrative as well, a little bit.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, you're right. It's not something I've thought about, but kind of off the cuff, one thing I would observe is that there's always kind of a lag between something happening in the culture, and then something, that thing becoming popularized, you know, in a more general way. So the sexual revolution originally was amongst a small minority avant-garde of hippies and intellectuals and musicians and university graduates in the late 60s.
I would say Willie Nelson's arguably one of the most famous ones.
Yeah, exactly. And but most of American society was very conservative. And it wasn't until the late 70s and the 80s that a lot of those once avant-garde ideas began to percolate in the larger society, and that basically sexual liberation became popular, as in most people, or more people, or a majority of people were kind of practicing it. And a lot of the expectations around sex had been eroded away. Mm. People were getting married later. That was probably the biggest change. The average age of marriage went from like 23 to 29 in about a decade.
And obviously the drugs as well in that time plays a huge part, as you had the word drugs later.
Exactly, and that is a good example of why this revisionism is currently happening. Because, and Joan Didion wrote about this at the time in Slouching Towards Bethlehem, the famous essay about Summer of Love, where you know a lot of this was pretty squalid. We're talking about people in communes. They'd probably taken too many drugs. And some guy with dodgy hair and some bell bottoms is making a move. It's not what we would understand as consensual sex. And a lot of those rough edges and unpleasant episodes were kind of historically glossed over. Mm. And now there was a big attempt to revise that, and an ongoing attempt to revise that and say, like, well, who benefited from this period of so-called sexual liberation? What was the, what were the material consequences of that for the people involved? When you look at it, not just at like the level of kind of some meme of freedom, but actually the lives that were affected.
And we're going to end a little bit now soon. And before we do, I want to talk about modern form of seduction, which is, and I mean, I obviously have Tinder myself, and you know, let's talk about online dating for a little bit, because you do spend a little part about talking about online dating as well.
Sure. I mean, and like I said, I think kind of my take on the sexual revolution was, as I said, it wasn't about liberation, it was about liberalization. And it was about the triumph of a basically an essentially economic model of viewing sexual interaction, so hyper-rationalized. And, you know, a lot of that seems quite abstract in practice until you get to the birth of online dating, where you see this kind of algorithmically led way of men and women interacting with each other, which really foregrounds a very kind of cold view of how humans interact with each other, and basically creates a kind of game theoretical environment for human interactions, which I think leaves a lot of people rather cold, because there's not much humanity in there, and there's a lot of kind of callousness and just indifference by design. So and if you look at one of the charts I show in the book was produced by a Stanford professor who's been studying these kind of long range trends.
Once again, I can show it right here again. If you are on YouTube, you should be able to see the graph right here.
Basically, there's a red line which goes from zero to like 40-50%, which represents how people are meeting through the internet. So that's a revolution that's happened in our lifetimes. It's gone from it didn't exist to something which is now the majority of how people meet. And I think that's really something worth dwelling on. We've lived through something which is unprecedented in history. There's the kind of online dating revolution. And it's worth thinking about what kind of behaviors does that incentivize? What kind of interactions does that enable? What kind of interactions does it not enable? I think it's something which really deserves and warrants thought, because at the end of the day, how people meet is actually one of the most important aspects of a human life. It will define a lot of things about someone's existence. So I think it's worth thinking about.
And you do write that, and I found this kind of sad story and quite fascinating as well, about this boy in a bar who could have been good looking, but he's, you know, the style he dresses in, it's quite peculiar.
Yeah, that's another part of the book which got picked up quite a lot by reviewers. And yeah, it's just an anecdote. It's something I saw in a bar in London, some guy clearly trying to do some kind of pickup artist thing and kind of flaming out quite spectacularly. And I included it in there because I think it's a good counterpoint to all of the sexual revolution kind of glossy storytelling, where in fact a lot of what's going on now is kind of everyone has these expectations which have been fostered by the media and by the kind of post-sexual revolution propagandizing of that revolution. And the reality is men and women trying and often failing to meet and make contact. And when you see it up close, it's kind of tragicomic. I included that in there just as a kind of reminder that all of these things are ultimately grounded in individuals and their interactions. And how people react to that story tells you a lot about where they stand on these issues. And so it's kind of a good test of like everyone sees something different, I think.
And obviously something that was a huge part by the time you were writing and publishing the book was the Harvey Weinstein allegations and, of course, the birth of the Me Too movement. And you write by the end of the book that, you know, at the time of writing, it was too early to tell how this movement will go, but I'm sure we can talk a little bit more about this now, as it's been quite a few years later since the Harvey Weinstein died and the Me Too movement, how it really ended up and how it's currently going. So let's talk about this before we wrap up the show.
Sure. I mean, you're right. And you, you've caught me at a good time, I suppose, because we are now, now 3 years since the book was published and 5 years or so since the Harvey Weinstein revelations. And I think it is an interesting time to think about the long range consequences of that. I think things have changed in a way that maybe people didn't expect. I think people, we mentioned before when we were talking just before we started recording that with COVID, a lot of the Me Too discourse kind of disappeared from the media, got taken over by other stories. And nowadays, I don't really
rightfully so.
Yeah, and like nowadays, I don't really hear the phrase much, Me Too. I don't really read about it, whereas a few years ago, it was everywhere. So in a sense, it could seem like it was just kind of a phase that came and went. I do think, though, it did leave a mark. I do think behaviors and expectations have changed, and people are a lot more guarded about a lot of these things in a way they wouldn't have been before, especially when it comes to the workplace. So we'll see. I'm not a member of Gen Z. My understanding about Gen Z norms is that they are a lot more sensitive about these kind of things. And that may well be in part because they grew up with that in the background. But, you know, things are complex. It's very hard to assign causation. I think there's probably a whole lot else going on, not least the kind of growth of social media and kind of everything being filmed and recorded the whole time, which probably means that a lot of people are probably going to be, just out of self-preservation, a lot more cautious. And the kind of freewheeling days of the kind of motley crew behavior you mentioned earlier is definitely definitely editing, I think.
So I think we're going to round it up there. Thank you so much for coming on. And before we go, do you have anything you want to promote? Social media, where people might find you if they have questions? And where can, of course, people find your book, which I'm holding up right here?
Yeah, the book is available everywhere that good books are sold. So yeah, please get by a copy if it sounds interesting to you. And I'm on Twitter at Clement Knox with two underscores between the words. So yeah, drop me a line.
Thank you so much for coming again. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. This has been That Aged Well. My name is Alan. We are available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, wherever you can find podcasts these days. Please check out some of our other episodes. I'm sure you will find something that you like. And we have some great episodes coming up as well. Please like, share, and subscribe. And I'll see you next time.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.